The reading this morning comes from the Gospel according to Luke, all of chapter 15. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and he eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you had 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and he says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided the property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to the fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? Here I am, starving to death. I'll set out to go back to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up, and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, and he was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son. He threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his finger, and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead, and he's alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants, and he asked him, 'What's going on?' 'Your brother's come home,' he replied, 'and your father's killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry. He refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all of these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Thanks, Andrew. A few weeks before Lent started, my fiancée, Rachel, thought that we together should give up sugar for Lent. She has the best self-discipline of anyone I know, so this is really more of like a, I think this is something that would be good for you and I can maybe help you do this. So I'm thinking, all right, I could do this. I can give up sugar. No problem. Cakes, cookies, I just don't have to buy them and I'll just have to say no when I see them. But then about... Well, I guess it was like the day before Lent started, she clarified what she'd meant, and she meant no sugar for Lent. So that meant reading the packaging on everything and making sure there was no sugar in it. And I don't know if you've ever been to the grocery store, but there's sugar in a lot of things that are really good that you wouldn't think sugar is in, like Doritos and Sriracha hot sauce. So I come before you as a man who has failed his Lenten task. Almost immediately. And I'd say she's still going strong. We were at the Mallows on Thursday night, and Melissa insisted that we have chocolate chip cookies that she'd made, despite knowing our Lenten pursuits. And if you're not safe at your pastor's house, I just don't know where you're supposed to go. So in this season of Lent, we are looking at conversations that Jesus had, conversations that stretched the people he was talking to, and conversations that will hopefully stretch us. And this morning, we're looking at a conversation Jesus had with some religious people. And I stand before you this morning as a super religious person. As Brandon said, I'm the youth pastor here, and when I'm not the youth pastor here, I'm studying theology at the University of Waterloo, and I've grown up in the church. And so needless to say, this is not how I dress on campus, but this is maybe sometimes how I feel in my day-to-day life. I want to outline and explore this idea of religion a little bit, and then we'll get into this longer chapter that Andrew's read for us, and then kind of what we make of all this. And so I think religion simply is a response, right? We believe that in order to cut through and connect with us, cut through the kind of the clutter, God became a person that we could interact with, and we formed a religion around that person of Jesus that we call Christianity. And this religion is a response out of love, right? It's an earnest desire to do right by that person, and it's based around instructions that Jesus and other kind of early church leaders gave around how we should kind of do this. And we've kind of built on it over the years and built a religion around our response and how we're supposed to kind of interact with God. And people do this in different ways, right? Churches express this response to God in very different ways. This morning is one expression. We do this often through worship, through maybe songs. We do it through giving, whether that's our time or our money. We can do it through different kinds of prayer, different ways of serving, through building relationships with the people that Jesus seemed to have a special heart for. We do this in different ways. This is one example. If you want another tangible example of how we do this, you could just sit in your pew for the next hour, and another church will come in right after us, St. John's, and they will do things slightly different. Their music might be a bit different. They might dress a bit differently, and the way they kind of communicate with God will be a bit different. I just had the opportunity to take a bunch of our youth from Bolivia. Our youth to Bolivia to meet some Bolivians. And we got a whole different flavor of what church is like. We went to a church service where the music was maybe loud, a bit more simple than what we have. There were special clothes that the people who were conducting the service wore. There was different, it was in a different language. Even the idea that God can be communicated to in different languages is something that we had to kind of wrestle with and explore together. And even the whole culture of Cochabamba where we were was quite different. This is an image of a statue called the Cristo, which in English means Christ. And it's overlooking the whole city. And so kind of depending on where you're at, you can see this beautiful picture of arms outstretched. Just something that colors the way they interact with God that we don't necessarily have here. I was trying to think of what would happen if we wanted to set one of these up in KW. And I think that if we're going to do it, Victoria Park would be a good location. But I think that if we're going to do it in Ontario, it should probably look like this guy. I don't know. That seems to be maybe more in line with what we'd maybe like Jesus to look like. And these practices, these different ways that we kind of practice, are not bad in and of themselves, right? Discipline and intentional time is needed to keep any relationship healthy. And often trying to get people to do that the same way can be really helpful. There's a lot of places in life where having people play by the same rules just makes things better, right? It wouldn't work very well if you had a bunch of people playing soccer and a couple people thought they were playing basketball, right? You kind of need everyone to be going along the same way in a lot of areas of life. But I think sometimes in religion this can get damaging when our commitment can become, I think our commitment can become only religious when we take the structures and forms that we've created over the self-revealed person of God, when they take priority. Taking these long-standing assumptions and practices about God over the personal God. And sometimes these can run deeper than we maybe realize. And I've kind of been reflecting that it's this difference between perhaps knowing a lot about God, but not knowing God. Like, I think in some senses, God can sometimes become like a famous person that we just hear about, that we don't actually have much of a relationship with. All of us have famous people that we look up to, or people that we kind of think are cool that we don't really know. For me, it was a band that I listened to a lot in high school, around the area, and I liked them. I loved all their music. I'd been a fan of them for years, and I was following them. And then one day, I was in Toronto, and the lead singer was in the lobby of the building I was in. And I was like, oh, it's the guy. It's the guy. And I went up to him, and I kind of awkwardly introduced myself, and we had like a kind of a little conversation and then left. And it was like an awkward little interaction. that didn't really change my relationship with him. And I left that experience thinking, like, I can know a lot about this guy, like the things he maybe puts out in songs or even just different things about his life, but I actually don't really know him as a person at all. And I think that that is a trap that we can sometimes fall into with God, knowing a lot about him but not knowing him. And sometimes I think it can go further where the things that we know about God can actually be false. I think a really tangible example is this guy. We've all seen this, and this is probably a common image of how we perceive Jesus, and this is white Jesus. Like, he's a super white guy, and we can see on the stained glass around even this building, right? Jesus is portrayed as a white guy. And I could totally intellectually be like, well, yeah, he was from Palestine, and he was Jewish, and so there's no way he looked like this. But if I'm honest, and I think if we're being honest, this is generally the picture of Jesus that I have in my head, even though it's probably not an accurate run. And what does this picture do for my understanding of God? If I can then maybe take not only the skin color, but maybe the practices of white Western culture and put them onto this God. So maybe I can start to think that God has the same values as me. Maybe God just really wants individuals to do their thing. Maybe Jesus just wants me to be happy. Maybe he just wants to keep me safe. Maybe he just values the same things as me. If I think that God looks like me, am I as open to others as I care to admit? And what if he doesn't maybe think these things? Am I open to exploring that if this is maybe the picture I have of who Jesus is in my head? So I think it can be damaging. Through my religious practices, have I defined then the way that people must try and interact with God? And is it mostly the way that I feel comfortable with that interaction? So in this passage, I think the religious leaders were wrestling with just that. The religious figures in this passage were struggling with their encounter with God because the practices and the structures they'd had in place for so, so long were being questioned and flipped by Jesus. God didn't seem to fit their understanding anymore. And so we have this person of Jesus, and he invites them into a conversation where he tells them a story to help them deal with this change that they're seeing happening around them through his ministry. People who didn't fit the structures and who weren't following the right structures seemed to be able to connect with God in a new way. And so in this chapter, I wanted us to specifically look at the verse right before the start of chapter 15, where he says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Because the start of chapter 15 is the sinners and tax collectors gathering, which to me implies they were hearing. They were arriving, and these are the people that Jesus was kind of inviting to hear. Now, when we say sinners, I think that gives us other connotations around what that might mean. I mean, in this time period, it could have been simply that their lifestyle habits just didn't fit some of the laws they had in place. So all of these structures and things were quite meticulous. So somebody who is perhaps a pig farmer, right? If, you know, pigs are kosher, if you're farming pigs, you're technically kind of unclean and maybe just not at the same level or able to get as close to God as somebody who isn't a pig farmer. Or somebody who worked in funerals, right, who was around dead bodies. There were rules around what you could do with kind of these uncleanness. And so there was this kind of hierarchy of who was kind of closer to God based on these things. I think there was definitely a lot of sin in the understanding that we have it as well around behavior and things, but that there would have been kind of these complex issues as well. And Jesus gives them welcome and recognition by eating with them. This was a way of showing hospitality, and he seems to be doing this in a way that disturbs the religious people who kind of had an idea of how they thought God was supposed to be. And so Jesus tells them some stories, and I want to focus mostly on the first one, where he compares them to sheep. Sheep is an image we get a lot of in the Bible of God comparing us to sheep throughout the Gospels, and it's one that I liked for a long time until I interacted with sheep. When I was done high school, I took a year off, and I went and I lived in Scotland for 6 months, and my next-door neighbors were sheep farmers, and sheep are just totally like this. Like, they're just dumb animals. Look at that. It's got poop hanging down from its fur. It's got something stuck in its head. You can't really, as far as I know, teach them much. They really need to be led. You have to drag them by the horns whenever you want to do anything with them. And so this metaphor of us being called sheep maybe is perhaps fitting, but has changed for me significantly. And so when I'm reading this story about the sheep who leaves and the shepherd who goes and finds it, I was struck by a couple questions that I don't think I've ever thought about before kind of wrestling with it for this morning. And the first one is, why did that sheep leave in the first place? It's never struck me before, but let's explore that a bit. Did it not fit in with the others, so it left? Did something set it apart that made it feel unwelcome? Perhaps the others told it to get lost. Perhaps it maybe just got far enough that it lost track of the others and just was simply disoriented. And maybe it was just a stupid animal that wandered. And so the shepherd, we're told, leaves the 99 to go find the one. And again, I think we have to ask why. Why did the shepherd feel comfortable enough to leave the 99 in search of the one without his guidance? Maybe they have had enough ideas and programs and memorization of the shepherd's instructions that they would be fine without him for a while. Maybe they wouldn't even notice he was gone because they didn't understand their need for his guidance. But whatever the reason, the shepherd does leave. He goes in search of the one, deeming it worthy enough for his full attention. I worked at camp for a number of years, and we would teach our staff missing camper drills, right? If a kid goes missing, what do you do? And something we would always emphasize is when you're looking for something that's lost, somebody who's lost, you use a calm voice. They're already probably nervous. They're already probably disoriented. You're not going to be having anger or inflection in your voice when you're out searching for someone. And so we can imagine that the shepherd is probably approaching it this way too. Not a lot of anger in his voice over the countless hours that this sheep is taking out of his probably scheduled day. And we read that when he finds the sheep, he puts it on his shoulders. He doesn't expect the sheep to follow along, to take instructions, or just keep the shepherd in sight. But the shepherd takes the weight of the sheep all the way back to the flock. I think if we can get past a lot of the really cheesy church art that's been done with this image, it is still a very powerful one for the way that God interacts with us. Jesus was eating with sinners, and that's what he was criticized for. He's willing to go to these places to redeem them back to the flock. We see a similar example in the parable of the lost coins, where a woman stops what she's doing and bends down to find what is lost. These stories show a God who seeks the lost, even without their cooperation, a God who's in pursuit of those who get lost, because we have no idea whether the sheep even wanted to come back. Maybe it was running away. I'm reminded of one of my favorite authors, C.S. Lewis, and his conversion. C.S. Lewis is probably most famous for writing the Narnia series. And he was an atheist for a while, and he writes in his autobiography about this moment of becoming a Christian, and he talks about this kind of pursuit of God, whether he wanted it or not. He says, "I felt, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had come at last upon me, and in 1929, I gave in. I admitted that God was God, and I knelt and I prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England." The religious leaders of the day, and perhaps we today, need a refocusing on the heart of the God that we are trying to earn the love of through religious practice. One of the commentaries I was looking at on this passage of God kind of leaving to pursue the lost says that God's love is a continuing challenge to all of our self-seeking. And I've been thinking about that I seek religious structures or attitudes to earn the love of God, to be in relationship with him. And it is still self-seeking, even if it doesn't manifest itself in the same way as those that I might deem to be sinful. I don't want to leave us with the impression that this love is only for the lost, and I think that those of us that have been trying this for a long time, that there's not a place for us, because I don't think that's true, and I think that Jesus anticipates this with his third story, because in the same chapter that we had read, he tells this parable of these two sons. The younger is like this lost sheep, and the elder is probably the one that a religious person like me can identify with easier. The youngest has left home and spent a lot of his dad's money and messed up big. And this story has particular resonance for me right now because, well, I've always been an oldest son, and I am the oldest in my family. And right now, my younger brother has left for a far and distant land. He's living in Seattle, and he's squandering my dad's money on prostitutes. So, no, he's not squandering. He's fine. But it is a story that I've always wrestled with, finding myself in one of these characters in a few different ways. The eldest son works for his dad. He's hardworking, he's not wasteful, he's faithful, and he's committed to the father. And so when the younger one returns, we read that the father is overjoyed that his son who was lost is found, and the elder is upset. "The younger one did not act the same as me, yet you still engage with him the same way, if not better." And the story goes that the father said to the eldest son, "All that is mine is yours." It was not an exclusion of the religious, but an invitation to share in his delight. As the son returns, hadn't he missed his brother as well? It doesn't seem to be part of what he's upset about. And in the Bible, we don't get the response of the older brother. We don't know whether he joined the party and entered the banquet or whether he left. Brendan and I were talking about that this week, and in some ways we were talking about how it's almost pointing to how it's written as an invitation for us to then think about our response. The fact that we don't get his response, I think, causes us to think, well, how would I respond in that situation? And I think it, for those religious leaders who are hearing this, that causes them reflection as well. And so how do we respond? What is your response? Do you find yourself a lost sheep, a younger brother, prone to wander from the God you love, as we sang this morning? Or are you a content one of the 99, perhaps not even aware of who has gotten lost, even if it may be you? Are we ready to admit that we have perhaps been the ones not entering the banquet and celebrating with the Father? Do we know a lot about God? Or do you know God in a very real and ongoing relational way? In his lifestyle and teaching, as we've been exploring, Jesus shocked people. He proposed that God sought the lost, and he enacted this in a real way through the mystery of the cross. His ministry was leading to this act that we'll be reflecting on 2 weeks from now, and I guess kind of ongoing through this process of Lent. It's a process that caused the religious and those who wandered but had ears to hear to rethink everything and change how they interacted and understood God and themselves. I want to invite the band back up because I want us to kind of reflect with a song. This is a song that we've sang a bunch around this church, but it's one that I heard a year ago, and I think it really does speak to this sense of having to shift through the stories and the ways that we know God, or the ideas of knowing a lot about God that can sometimes get in the way of knowing the heart and the character of God as is revealed in parables like this one, these ones. The chorus, I think, is a great affirmation of the caring heart of God that we are to draw close to and that will draw close to us. So let's sing this together.